This is a Connectability Radio production.
Managing aggressive behavior proactively with behavior services consultant Doug McMahon in conversation with Nancy Hendy.
We're here today with Doug McMahon, behavior services consultant for Community Living Toronto. Doug, you've had lots of experience working with children who have behavioral difficulties.
Yeah, I have.
A lot of ECEs are concerned about the challenges involved in working with aggressive children. Is there anything we can do? Where do we start?
Yes, Nancy, there is. It's important to remember, first of all, though, that you're probably not going to be able to eliminate aggression entirely. But if you do your homework right, it's possible to reduce it substantially. And if you succeed in doing that, well, you're ahead of the game.
Okay, so how do we do that?
Well, first of all, by being proactive. The best way to deal with aggression is to stop it from happening in the first place. Now, one way you can do this is to identify a kid's triggers to aggressive behavior and change or remove them somehow. I want to tell you a little story about a guy I supervised at a residential camp a couple of years ago. He had anger management problems and he loved his food. So he walked up to the concession stand at this camp and threw some money down on the countertop, wanted to buy an ice cream cone. Well, he didn't have enough money. And when he was told that by the concession stand attendant, he began to get angry. I walked up to this guy and reprimanded his behavior, and, well, I had an ice cream cone in my hand. Now, didn't I? What do you think happened to me?
Well, you probably got ice cream in the face.
Yeah, that's not the only thing I got in my face. Ice cream and this guy's fist. Now, I realized after I had done that, it was stupid. But it's a good example of antecedent control. If you have to tell somebody that they can't do something or have something, and it's right in front of them, and they have anger management issues, well, they're probably going to have some sort of an outburst. So, the strategy for this gentleman would be to simply, you know, correct his behavior, but make sure that I'm not eating ice cream in front of him while I do that.
That's for sure.
People might want to refer to the ABC data sheet under the tools section in positive behavior supports. And what this is it's a tool that allows you to track antecedents, which refer to what is going on or happening immediately before the behavior, in this case aggression, presents itself. And by tracking these antecedents or things that go on beforehand, sometimes you can remove them or change them or change the time at which you present them so that the person does not have an outburst. In this case, I once again would be eating my ice cream cone later, not when I'm telling this guy that he can't have one. Does that make sense?
It sure does.
Okay. So antecedent analysis to get rid of triggers is one way in which you be proactive about these things.
That's useful information. Are there other ways to be proactive?
Yeah. If you know a child well enough and you can read their escalation pattern, you can intervene before things get physical.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? How exactly?
Sure. Okay, think of somebody who you know really, really well, Nancy. Now, can you sometimes tell when that person is getting mad?
Sure.
Most of us can. How do you know?
Well, their facial expression may change. They may get an increased activity level.
Right, those are good examples. Now, some kids display what I call these early warning signs that tell you that they're building towards a physical outburst. By intervening before they get to the point of physical outburst, by changing their environment, by dealing with them early on and counseling them, you can often prevent aggressive behavior. Let's look at what a build-up to aggressive behavior looks like, one stage or step at a time, and appropriate reactions by adults to each stage. People might want to refer here to the aggression continuum and de-escalation checklist in the library section. So what you find at stage one on an escalation continuum for a child is there's some sort of a subtle behavior change. The child's energy level may change. There are changes in verbal behavior. If the person is normally very quiet, they might become quite talkative all of a sudden. If the kid is very, very talkative and you can't get a word in edgewise, they might suddenly go very quiet. There's usually a change in their social interaction with supervising adults, and there usually are mood changes as well. All of these early signs mean something. What staff need to do at stage one is get in there and start counseling the kid. You want to encourage talking. You want to gather information about recent events. I notice you're very quiet, Nancy. Did anything happen at school today that you want to talk about? That type of thing. You want to give positive feedback to the child. You want to change the feedback schedule, which is to say give more of it, more often, and encourage them to keep talking. And if you do all of that well at stage one, what will happen a lot of the time is that the kid will feel better and they will no longer be building towards a physical outburst. Sometimes, though, it has to be remembered that you can do all the right things at any of these stages and the kid will progress to the point of physical outburst anyway. That doesn't mean that this isn't a useful tool and that you've done something wrong. It simply means that sometimes there are factors out there or unusual situations that you can't control. So, if you do your job correctly, hopefully it won't go beyond stage one. If you're in the middle of one of those situations that can't be controlled, or you don't do your job quite so well, perhaps the kid may move on to stage two. And at this stage, what you're going to see is an increase in questioning towards adult instructions. What should I do that for? No, why should I? Who made you God? That type of stuff. The verbal retorts and direct challenges to adult authority will be seen at this stage. There's increased resistance to carrying out tasks that you might want the kid to do. And there's readily observable physical tension at this stage as well. Nancy, there's no guesswork about it anymore. The child is definitely getting mad, and you can see that now. They have issues with authority, as I said, and at this point, as adults, we are starting to feel just some slight loss of control because we can see the kids getting agitated. Appropriate responses by adults at this stage are to reassure and show understanding of where the kid is at. You need to be non-judgmental. You need to control your presentation. You need to be very neutral in your affect. Do not raise your voice. Watch your tone of voice. Watch your facial expression. You want to state the facts and describe what you're observing about the child's behavior. And you want to ask simple, concrete questions. Identify and empathize with their feeling states. And if you do your job well at this stage, hopefully, once again, the kid will not progress on to stage three, which is verbal aggression. No more guesswork about it. You have definite temper issues here. The kid is mad. You're going to see things such as swearing, other obscenities perhaps, directed towards you. Explosive speech, they're yelling at this point usually. They may threaten possible harm to you or to their peers. There are accompanying gestures of aggression, threat gestures such as, you know, clenching your fist and shaking it at the person. And they're saying stuff like, try and make me. There are direct challenges here. At this point, adults need to reestablish boundary control. You do that by reminding the person of pre-established, mutually agreed upon parameters. In other words, all right, I can see you're upset. This is what happens when you act out. Is this what you want? You need to choose your wording very carefully here, Nancy. You need to point out the natural outcomes or consequences that happen to every kid when they lose control and act out physically. It's not about what you as a supervising adult are going to do to the child to punish them if they don't settle down right now. You need to make your wording choices very carefully. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, good. You're asking at this point for suggestions and alternatives, giving choices to the child. You're reminding them of what the consequences once again will be if they choose to lose control any further. And if you do your job well at that stage, once again, hopefully it won't go further than that and the child will settle down, or they may go to stage four, which is physical aggression, hitting, kicking, scratching, throwing of objects, all of that lovely stuff we don't want to see. At this point, you have to reestablish control of the situation as fast as you can. I'll talk a little later about self-protection skills that you would use during episodes like this. The person will need a cool-down period. You need to secure the environment. You need to get other kids who might act as targets out of there. You need to see to your own physical protection, using the environment to protect yourself or any self-protection devices that you can find. More on this later as well. And you want to just let the child come out of it. They need a cool-down period once again before you can talk to them and debrief about the incident. In instances where you need to intervene physically, you should not touch the child at all, if you can possibly avoid it, but if that proves necessary, do only what's necessary and no more. You might have to use graduated guidance, for example, to physically prompt them in or out of an area. It's important to remember that this slow build-up to aggression will look different for everybody, Nancy. It can also change for a given individual over the course of time, so it's important to update your individualized escalation continuum for individual kids and your staff responses to these on a regular basis. This is best done as a team, and the reasons for that are a child might behave towards you in one way when they're getting mad, and a member of your staff in another way. By bringing all of the players to the table and having each player describe what they see individually, well, you're getting a more complete picture of the child. Think about it like constructing a puzzle. The more pieces you have, the easier it is to get a clear picture of what's going on. Now remember, too, that the kid can skip stages. They don't always go through from stage 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. Sometimes they can jump ahead to stage 4 immediately without warning, or they can be at stage 2 and all of a sudden jump ahead to 4 without warning.
So, Doug, what about those kids who just suddenly aggress without warning?
Reality? Sometimes it happens, and you just have to deal with it right there. Now, there are several self-protection skills I want to talk about that you should remember here. And once again, this is found in the library section. You might want to refer to it. The first self-protection skill has to do with scanning your environment, doing an environment scan. You need to be very, very aware of the way your setting is laid out, how it works in ways that help to keep you safe, and how it may work in ways that put you at risk. You wouldn't, for example, want to have someone who's aggressive between you and the only door that allows you to exit the room. You need to be aware here of the layout of the furniture. Are there obstacles that would keep a child from accessing other kids as targets if they got physically aggressive? Can you rearrange the furniture in the room to advantage to make it difficult for that child to target others who are in the room? You want to be aware of things in the room that can be used to protect you. Some settings have these lightweight blue gym mats that make excellent shields, for example. And sometimes, whatever is around, pillows, cushions, and reading or activity centers can be used as self-protection devices for yourself or for other children as well. I've seen women use their purses. But basically walk through your environment and see what's in it that can be used to help you and provide a shield against physical aggression, and make sure that the flow of traffic is open as well, so that there are many avenues for people to exit or get out of the way if a child chooses to act out physically. The next self-protection skill I want to talk about is something called safe or critical distance. This is the length of a person's leg, Nancy, plus one step forward. And this is the minimum distance that you need to be standing away from someone in order to be safe from physical attack. Now, the reason for that is, when someone goes to kick you, very often what they will do is take one step forward before doing it. So when you're dealing with a child who is escalating, or worse yet, who goes right to stage 4 without any of those early warning signs, you want to be very aware that this is the distance you should be standing away from the child in order to be safe from any type of physical attack. But remember that safe distance is a fluid concept. If the child is holding something that can be used as a weapon, or a projectile, for example, well, safer critical distance increases to approximately how far that kid can throw that. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, great. You want to be aware as well that sometimes it will be necessary to get people out of the space, perhaps out of the room altogether. This self-protection skill is called abandon ship. You want to be able to evacuate people as quickly as you possibly can so that you are removing potential targets, yourself, other children included. A good way to do that is to use what we call a cue word. And this can be anything you want. In some program locations that I provide support to, we use the word assistance, for example. And once again, it doesn't matter what you use. You want a word that, when you use it, people know to drop what they're doing, come and help you, and provide support to help you deal with that aggressive situation. Now, once all of this is over, what you need to do is debrief with everybody who was involved in the incident. All of your staff team should give their own perspective on what happened, those who witnessed the event. And once again, you're all going to have different pieces of the puzzle here. You've got to bring all that together to make sense of the situation and what happened, and hopefully come up with strategies on how to keep it from happening again.
Doug, I'd like to ask you about the leadership. Who takes on the leadership role during an aggressive outburst?
Okay, that's an important thing to talk about, actually. The leader is the person who is directly dealing with the child when they're having an aggressive outburst. Now, ideally, you want the person who is the leader in this situation to be the person who knows the child best, the person who has the best skills to de-escalate that child, the best relationship with that child. But reality, the leader changes on a day-to-day basis. You can't count on that person always being there, quite obviously. Staff get sick. Sometimes they are not there to witness what happens immediately, which makes intervening later, if you don't know what led up to the outburst, dangerous. Everybody will probably have a go at being the leader in dealing with this situation sooner or later, Nancy, and that's appropriate. You want that to happen because then all of your team develop the same skills in terms of learning how to de-escalate not only that particular child, but other children well. The leader, in short, is the person who is right there to deal with the situation immediately. And leadership doesn't change. If the most highly skilled person at dealing with that kid entered the scene after another staff member had taken on leadership for dealing with the situation, you would not take leadership away from that person. That's inappropriate, and it's dangerous. The other people who arrive later are support staff, and the role of support staff in a situation like this is to do basically whatever the leader tells you. You take your cues from that person. They're going to be doing things like securing the environment to remove breakable objects, things that could possibly be used as weapons. They're also going to secure the environment by getting other potential targets, kids, out of the way. Other than that, you do whatever the leader tells you to do and give them whatever they say they need at any given moment. The library section contains a section on team coordination, roles, and support.
Sounds good.
Okay, great.
So, Doug, what about restraining a child if they get out of hand? What's your opinion on that?
That's not an option, Nancy, and here's why. Now, restraint, first of all, is dangerous at the best of times. There's a great likelihood that the child can get hurt without you meaning for that to happen. There's also a great likelihood that staff can get hurt, and obviously you don't want that to happen either. So, when you need to use restraint, you need to use approved restraints by the ministry, and you need to be trained in their use. But even then, it's not a good idea. Because when you are trained or certified to carry out these sorts of procedures, the reality is, in most settings, you don't need to do that every day, so you don't practice the skills every day. You also may not have trained with your team, which you need to do if you're going to execute certain forms of restraint well and competently. And what this means is you're not going to be proficient at it. It will be sloppy. It will be misused. You probably won't remember how to carry out the technique 100% correctly because you haven't practiced it since training. And once again, because of all these things, the risk for injury goes up. So training by itself does not certify or empower you to carry out a procedure like this. It's dangerous. So don't do it. And it's been my experience over the years as a behavior consultant that 99 out of 100 times, you don't need to restrain a person anyway. There are other ways to deal with this stuff. You can do the de-escalation strategies that we've talked about. You can change the environment. Generally speaking, if a kid is getting mad or there is threat or risk here, change what you're doing. Change the environment. But at all costs, do not restrain the child. Now, obviously there are rare exceptions to that. When it's permissible to restrain, when the kid is doing something which is seriously dangerous to themselves or others. For example, if a child is running headlong into traffic, well, you do what you have to do. And then you write all your incident reports, speak with your supervisors, and sort it out later.
That's true, Doug. Is there any other tips?
Yes. When you do need to use a physical restraint, on those very rare occasions, you need to be aware of the following stuff. You need to be aware that you need to use a technique for restraint that has been approved by the ministry. You are responsible for being trained and certified to carry it out. You are responsible for practicing the technique so that your skills are sharp. And there are very stringent reporting requirements as well. Some form of written notification, an incident report, depending on center, some form of written documentation is always necessary. It's always necessary to inform the family, the supervisors, the higher-up managers, and there are documentation requirements here. These incidents also must be reported and the appropriate paperwork completed within 24 hours, no exceptions. Consult with your center supervisors regarding your specific reporting requirements and documentation requirements. I'd like to add as well that there's no substitute for individual problem solving as a team. Training is a wonderful thing. And strategies like the ones we're talking about will help you in some situations, yes, but they often take you only so far. There's no substitute, by my experience, for problem solving around individual case needs. I'd like to tell you a story, if I could, about a day camp I consulted to a few years ago. This young child was in danger of being thrown out of this camp program because he was constantly hitting staff and other children. Well, I met with the supervisor, the one-on-one support worker, and a couple of other staff members as well. And what we came up with, because the behavior was so frequent and so upsetting to everybody in the camp, we had everybody bring their backpacks into work, everybody had one, and remove their personal effects from it. They stuffed the backpack with pillows, and all staff people were required to carry this around with them at all times. What this meant, Nancy, was that each staff had a portable shield that they could use to protect themselves if he suddenly turned around without warning and started to hit at them, or if he went for another child. They could stick that same backpack in between the two kids to act as a shield. Now, I point out that this didn't get rid of the behavior entirely. Once again, that very seldom happens. But it did cut down the hitting behavior substantially enough that this kid was able to complete his time at camp. Everybody was quite happy with the solution. So that's an example of individual problem solving appropriate to the setting and to the case. In some instances, what you may need to do is construct an individualized aggression management plan, such as what we did for that child. And once again, some may want to look in the library section to find a copy of this plan. There's also a set of guidelines which explains how to fill this out. So those are some general strategies that you can try to deal with aggression proactively and to protect yourself and minimize impacts when it happens without warning. At the end of the day, if you have tried all of these things, you are convinced you've done your homework well, and you still aren't getting very many positive results. In other words, the aggression is still going on about as often as it did before. Well, you just may need the help of a specialist, a behavior therapist perhaps, or other clinical professional.
That's actually really good advice, Doug. And I know that child care professionals can get that type of support through their special needs resource consultant who's assigned to their daycare, or they can call directly to their local children's mental health agency.
Right. I'd just like to end off, Nancy, by saying that not only is that a good idea, it's a necessary one, I think, for staff. When you're dealing with stuff like this, it tends to be quite isolating for staff, I think. You feel it's your problem and you should be able to deal with it. After all, you're the adult and this is a child you're dealing with. It's always appropriate to ask for help. You have the right to ask for help. Don't be afraid to do that.
Thanks very much for your time today, Doug.
Oh, thank you for asking me.